wish yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, Audio 99 Percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show, Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to talk about Greece. Wow, things are really getting heated up over there. Looks like there may be a default possible, or maybe it's just the typical maneuvers to make it look like it's a tough deal and we're not giving in easy, and both sides are sort of posturing here before they actually cut a deal. I think the latter is more likely 60-40 maybe than the conflict and a default. Okay, what's the conflict? Well, there were meetings yesterday and the IMF, International Monetary Fund, representatives walked out. Ooh, hardball bargaining right before the 11th hour here. The Troika. Troika, made up of the European Central Bank, made up of the European Commission, and the IMF. All of them have a piece of the 270 billion euro debt of Greece. Huge amount of debt of Greece. And for years now, they've been demanding that Greece make payments on that debt. And of course, pretty much eats up any amount of economic growth that Greece may be able to eke out, just trying to come out of a seven-year depression caused by the collapse of 2008-09, and then even more debt piled onto debt by these Troika. Okay, so Greece can't afford. They can barely afford to keep their economy going. And, you know, the Troika wants every bit of money they make that they converted into paying on the debt, which means that Greece is in a perpetual depression if it does nothing. And that's why they elected Syriza here, the Greek people. The new moderate left government put in place in January on a mandate that they weren't going to continue this perpetual depression condition by paying everything to the Troika, that there had to be some sort of compromise, you know, some money to keep the economy going as well as debt. Oh, the hardliners don't want to do that. Troika does not want to do that. You know, they're bankers. And their whole mantra is, thou shalt make your payments on principal and interest, no matter what. Yeah, I'll get a pound of flesh from you. You know, the Shylocks there in Northern Europe, the bankers. Okay, that's the situation, and, you know, there's been moving back and forth in bargaining here, and end of February they agreed to extend it to June 30th, both sides, and continue negotiating. Well, the Troika, led by the German bankers, pretty much, and the Netherlands bankers and so forth, pretty much say, you know, all we want is the same-o. You should... you know, just extend the past agreements that we've had with you here. And Greece says, well, that means extending depression. And no, we're not going to do that. And the parties have gone back and forth, with some minor moves here and there. And so we are coming up to the deadline date of June 30th. June 30th is the deadline. And the Troika is telling Greece that, look, we need a couple weeks here, because if we're going to even extend the old terms that we like, then we have to get our parliaments to agree to them, especially the German parliament, agree to the extension. So we need 2 weeks before June 30th. And they've been issuing more or less ultimatums to Greece. You know, agree to the arrangement that we have had in place or else. And they've been withholding money that Greece should have got, even under the old arrangements. Under the old arrangements, Greece should have been given by the Troika 7.2 billion euros of additional loans. But the Troika is refusing to release those loans. And there's another $1 billion that Greece should have received from interest on Greek bonds held by the European Central Bank. That's not been paid either. And the ECB, one of the Troika, has been dribbling out money to the Greek banks just to keep them from collapsing. So we have this situation where the screws have been tightening little by little by the Troika on the Greeks, trying to force them to concede and extend the agreement as is. And they've been even violating the old terms that they want the Greeks to agree to. So ironic, isn't it? Ironic that the Troika refuses to abide by the agreement that is telling the Greeks they must abide by. Well, that's the way bankers deal with you. Greece is couldn't make an IMF payment a couple weeks ago. It was a small payment, small relative, about $1 billion to the IMF. But the IMF agreed, okay, roll that into the payment you also owe us at the end of June. So they got over that slight hurdle. But now, there's 1.5 billion euros that are due to the IMF at the end of June that haven't been paid. And there's another 3.5 billion euros, I believe, payable to the ECB, that's European Central Bank, or the Commission, European Commission, which is really all about finance ministers for the Northern Europeans. 3.5 billion euros, so that's 5 billion euros. That's about like $5.5 billion. Where's Greece going to get this money? Pretty difficult proposition for them. Oh, well, they were supposed to be loaned it, 7.5 billion euros, by the Troika, but they won't release that, you see. So we're right back where we were, and they're running out of time. They believe, the Troika does, and they are giving Greece ultimatums, and now they're walking out. It reminds me of labor negotiations. When you get to the 11th hour, you usually have one or more just walking out of negotiations to sort of emphasize that this is our best offer. I wrote an article several months ago published in Telesur, that I write for frequently. That's the South America media conglomerate. And the title of it was Greek Debt Negotiations as Labor Negotiations. There's a lot of similarities there going on. So we're seeing a lot of this is our best final offer kind of attitude going on here in the negotiations. And the question is, whether Greece will default. Will it default on the payments due on June 30th? Or will it extend? Or will both parties extend the agreement, the old agreement that's been extended since March 1st? Will they extend it again to gain a little bit more time here in July and August? My guess is they will extend it again. They'll go down to the wire here, and it'll look like there will be a breakup and a default, but both sides will agree to extend it to buy more time to negotiate. The hard line here is pretty clear on the part of the Troika. For example, Donald Tusk. Tusk is the head of the European, I think he's the president of the European Commission. I think that's what he is. And, he's been issuing hardline statements. So have some of the others been issuing hardline statements. And Tusk pretty much said recently here to, in fact, reported today in the Global Business Financial Times said, quote, there's no more space for gambling. There's no more time for gambling. Oh, in other words, they negotiate, but Greece gambles. The day is coming, I'm afraid, where someone says the game is over. Well, whose game? You're trying to tell me that the Troika has no game here? I think they got a game. I think the game is to squeeze grease till they holler and make them sign the old agreement again. That's their game. Or, you know, their game might even be forcing Greece to put it to a vote of the Greek people. In other words, again, it looks like labor negotiations, contract negotiations. Here's our last best offer, the Troika says. Go take it to your members for a vote, right? That's their way of testing whether Syriza and its president Tsipras really has the support of the people, the Greek people, on the position that Tsipras is assuming. You know, when Tsipras and Syriza, the party in the Greek government, say, no, we're not going to agree to this or that, you know, the Troika is, well, I'm not so sure that the people there in Greece won't agree to this or that. I think they're forcing Greece and trying to force Greece to take it to a vote. It would be a stinky, stinky settlement. You know, hold your nose. Don't recommend it. Take it to your bargaining unit members, the Greek people here, Tsipras and Syriza, and let's see what the vote is. If the vote is real close to accept the Troika's last best offer, you know, we're not going to change our position. But, you know, if the people overwhelmingly say, Troika, go to hell, we're not going to do this anymore, well, then maybe we'll have to sweeten the pot a little bit here, right? And I think that's kind of what's going on. I think the Troika strategy is to go down on a wire and force Greece to put it to a vote of the people and extend the agreement as is for another 30, 60 days, whatever, over the summer in order to have time for that vote. I think that's what's going on. Well, we'll see. Maybe I'm absolutely wrong here. You know, maybe they are going to head for a default. Well, what is a default? Well, a default simply means you didn't make payments on, a payment tranche that was due, right? Payments meaning principal and interest. You didn't make your $1.5 billion you owed the IMF here, on June 30th. That's a default, right? That's a default. And there's lots of ways to get around default. You know, both parties can agree to extend the payment and roll it into the next payment due, in June, July 20th. And then technically they haven't defaulted, technically, you see. That's a possibility as well, right? Another reason I think that the Troika is trying to force this to a popular vote is that Syriza, the party, only has a 12-member majority in its Greek parliament. And I'm sure they're hoping that if they put it to a re-election, Syriza will have to have a new election as the basis for putting it to a popular vote or not, or maybe the re-election would be the signal of a popular vote. Same thing, vote of confidence. Maybe Syriza will lose its very narrow majority, and then the Troika will be able to negotiate with a new party or compromise or coalition government that's a little bit different than what exists now, and the Troika will have a better bargaining partner there than Syriza, right? You can't separate the politics out of this situation, both politics on both sides of the bargaining table here. The politics in the north, and we'll talk about that, involving the Troika, you know, who's behind the Troika and the politics there, both national politics and banker politics. And you can't separate what's going on in Greece in terms of what's going on between the parties and public opinion in Greece, and even within Syriza. The left wing is raising its head and shouting, no, no. You know, no more extension of this. There could be a split in Syriza. And maybe that's what the Troika wants. Maybe they want to see the split in Syriza. And then they can negotiate with a much more compliant coalition government and the more conservative wing, if that's the right term, of Syriza. Because Syriza is made up of popular forces, but also small businesses and so forth. It's a populist, democratic populist government. It's not a socialist government. It's not a labor government. It's a coalition. So maybe part of the strategy here is to see how they could disrupt that coalition within Syriza and within the Greek parliament and change the conditions for the negotiations. To do that, they've got to bring they the Troika have to bring it to a head here in terms of payments and put a greater squeeze on Greece on the banking system and on a whole number of other conditions here. So the immediate question is, will Greece default? What's the consequences if it doesn't make this payment on June 30th to the IMF and does not extend the agreement? I believe it's unlikely they won't extend the agreement, worst case. But maybe who knows what can happen? The parties can, the negotiators can really upset their relationships to each other, get emotionally in a difficult position, don't like each other because the demands are too tough, and the personalities come into play here as well, right? So who knows? It could miss the default, not extend, or they could miss the default, miss the payment, and extend, right? Or the third option is just agree to everything that the Troika wants. Well, I don't think the third option is going to happen. And I think it's unlikely that they will default or not extend. So most likely, I think, is the possibility that they will agree to roll forward the agreement and roll forward the payment, IMF payment due on the 30th as well, which means everything moves forward in 30, 60 days. Everything changes, nothing changes, okay? And we're right back where we were with this bargaining situation going on here. But what if they do default? Let's say that they miss the payment. There's no rolling it forward. What are the consequences for Greece? Well, the consequences can be significant. What you're going to have is a psychological fear factor escalate. And you're going to see even more capital flight out of Greece. Those people with money are sending their money out just in case. They've been doing that for some time, but it certainly will escalate. Sending your money where? Well, to northern banks, northern European banks, and elsewhere, stock markets in Europe, etc. Those who do have money, because those who had money in Greece, a lot of it is because they just refused to pay taxes. We have a lot of business and wealthy people in Greece under the previous government that just refused to pay taxes, which of course exacerbated the debt situation in Greece. Because if they had more taxes, they could more easily pay the debt down. That's one of the problems in Greece. Wealthy capitalists and others have been engaging in massive tax fraud and tax avoidance, and Syriza's trying to change that, but the Troika isn't so impressed with that particular way of changing it. Instead of raising taxes on the rich to pay for their debt, Troika wants Greece and Syriza to cut pensions, to cut wages, to cut jobs, to privatize government public services and goods. That's the solution they want, and I'll explain why that's their preferred solution shortly. They're not so interested in raising taxes on the rich folks, their friends there in Greece. So there's a difference between Syriza and the Troika on that question of do you make your debt payments by cutting workers' wages, benefits, so forth, or do you make your debt payments by raising taxes on the rich? You know, that's a difference between the two that's behind the scenes. Capital flight thus would be a consequence if Greece defaulted, i.e., didn't pay make the payments then when they were due and they weren't extended by the Troika in mutual agreement. Okay, but what else would that mean? That would also mean Greek bonds, which are also at like 25% interest rate paying on bonds, would shoot even higher than they are now. You know, you'd certainly almost double, I would think. Okay, very, very unstable situation in terms of Greek bonds. I think the only other country in the world that's got a worse government bond instability crisis is the Ukraine. Oh, that's another IMF squeeze going on there, but we'll talk about that on another occasion. So Greek bonds would go up. And what happened, with Greek bonds? Well, bonds that high and so forth, no one's going to invest in bonds, Greek bonds, because they're very, very unstable, possibility of not being paid. So, the government wouldn't be able to borrow money in open markets at all, and that would make the debt situation even worse. The Greek banks may crumble. They're barely surviving. They're on the what do you call it? When you're almost dead, you're on life support by the ECB, who's been trickling money, little bit here, a little bit there, just to keep Greek Central Bank and the Greek banks going. They would possibly collapse as well. And if the Troika really wanted to put the screws even worse, that's what they would do with Greece. They would get the central bank ECB, freeze up all money, all loans to the banks there, even though the European and Eurozone rules and regulations for members requires them to maintain those banks in Greece. And they would just let it fall. And that would really put the screws on Greece. Depression would even get worse in Greece than it is. So, they've got some arrows in their economic quiver still, the Troika. That could even wound Greece even more if they wanted to, if there was a default. Oh, but if they did that, just think about it. If Greek bonds went up to 50% interest rates from the 25 now, and Greek banks went under. All these banks have connections with each other in Europe and globally as well. And who knows who, what banks are holding what notes and what securities of other banks. I mean, the contagion effect is unknown, but it could be very significant on the rest of the European banking system. It's not unknown. Even the quote experts who are supposed to know these exposures don't know them because they are so complex and so opaque. It's the way the global banks work and banks work in general. So you've got this situation that if they really put the screws on Greece, it might result in contagion effects on the rest of the euro economy, and your economy is not doing so good. Even with trillions of dollars of quantitative easing announced a few months ago by the European Central Bank, it's had a little effect, mostly on stocks and so forth. A lot of this QE stuff has to do with other global QEs and interest rate movements and so forth. They don't have total control over it. It could backfire on them, on the Northerners and the ECB. The ECB is really run, controlled by the big bang, big countries, big banks. Germany is really in the driver's seat, in the Eurozone, and France and Italy, which are kind of quasi-basket cases themselves, are barely able to exert influence. So it's a coalition of in the EU and Eurozone of the Dutch, Netherlands and the Germans and Luxembourg and a few others that are really calling the shots in the Eurozone banking system. So there could be a lot of instability within the financial system within Europe here if they really pulled out the troika, pulled out the plugs and really tightened the screws even further on Greece. And Greece kind of knows this. You know, Tsipras and Syriza say, hey, you know, you don't have all the ammunition you think you do, and don't try to intimidate us into thinking you do. There are consequences for you, Northern German bankers and so forth, if you don't come to some agreement with us on this situation of this debt. You see, they allowed this debt to get so high in Greece that it's unsustainable for Greece, and it's an amount that even for Europe is unsustainable. $270 billion, euros. You know, euros are about 1.15 to the dollar. So, you know, you've got something like $300 billion of debt. How did it get so high? Well, it got so high because of the creation of the Eurozone and what went on after the euro was created in 1999. What went on between 2000 and 2007, debt was run up everywhere in Europe, particularly in the periphery, southern periphery, but other peripheries of the European Union as well. Just very similar to the way debt was run up in the U.S. during this period. Within Europe is a kind of a microcosm for the U.S. Similar crisis. It's like the same crisis evolving on a smaller scale than evolved in 2007, 2008, 2009 globally, with U.S. and to some extent the U.K. at the center of that crisis, which was really because too much debt run up. We'll explain that shortly here later in this show. It has to do with what was called the twin deficits. The twin deficits, a new strategy of neoliberalism that was introduced in the early 1980s. You know, neoliberalism is generally thought of this strategy of corporations and capitalists and their governments coming out of the crisis of the 1970s when they tried to put a new system together to resurrect the global economy that was in big trouble, particularly in the advanced economies. Sometimes called Reaganism, sometimes called Thatcherism in the UK, Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. Well, you know, there they just happened to be the politicians in control at the time. This neoliberalism strategy was created in the late 1970s, introduced in the 1980s. But most folks who write about neoliberalism and criticize neoliberalism do not understand the role of trade and money capital flows that were rearranged and restructured in the 1980s that are part of neoliberalism as well, right? And that has to do with this thing called the twin deficits in the U.S. That was created in the 1980s. What are the two deficits we're talking about? We're talking about the budget deficit, U.S. budget deficit, and the U.S. trade deficit. We have a similar kind of deficit arrangement that occurred after the creation of the euro in 1999 within Europe, where deficits were created in trade relationships in order to finance budget deficits, right? Kind of a de facto twin deficit arrangement in the Eurozone as well. Okay, so I guess this is a good time to talk about that a little bit more, because what it means is what is the origin of the Greek debt crisis? You know, you have to understand the origins to understand what's been going on and why Greece ended up with such a huge debt of $300 billion. And, of course, it can't pay it off. Its economy is too small to pay that off without just a massive depression for years to come. That's the only way, and maybe even then they couldn't pay it off. Okay? So to understand this huge Greek debt and why it's not payable, and therefore why it needs to be radically restructured. Restructuring here means they're just going to have to forego, expunge some of the debt that Greece owes, because Greece cannot continue paying for it. Right? And that's kind of what the Syriza has been saying all along. Syriza has been saying, you know, let us grow out of our crisis so that we can pay you interest on this debt and pay down the debt itself. If Greece is not growing, if its GDP is not growing, it can't generate enough government income to pay anymore. So let us grow some more. Let us grow a little faster. Now, to grow a little faster, that means Greece has to eliminate the austerity measures, at least a good number of them, because the austerity measures are making things even worse in terms of growth and therefore generation of government income in order to make payments on this debt. You can't remain in depression and solve this problem. And Syriza and Greece are saying, hey, you know, let us grow a little more, which means let us pay less to you and use more of our growth to finance additional growth so that we can pay you. And we got to get GDP, economic growth, up. We can't do that if we're tightening the screws on everybody, reducing their income here. At one level, the big debate between the Troika and the Greeks are, Syriza and the rest of the Greek people versus the Troika, is how much of the surplus we're creating in economic growth is going to go back into the Greek economy to help it grow more, and how much of that surplus is going to be dedicated to servicing the old debt. If you do the latter, you're never going to grow. Greece wants to create just a surplus of less than 1%. In other words, its income and its growth will be plowed back into trying to stimulate the economy. I think it's 0.8%. Whereas the Troika wants, they want a surplus of 3.5%. In other words, create 3.5% so you can pay us back, right? In other words, you're going to have to reduce spending to get that much on programs, on wages, on government jobs, pensions, and so forth, if you want to get that back up and pay us. So at one level, it's 0.8% versus 3.5%. But what that really reflects under the covers is how much are you going to put back into the economy to keep it growing, and how much of it you're going to take out to pay these northern bankers, you know? And, of course, the arrangement up to now, since 2010 in particular, has been take it all out and pay us back, right? But the question is, how did all that debt that has to be paid back, that they want to be paid back, how did it accumulate? How did this happen? That the Greek government got so deep in debt. And by the way, it's not the Greek government, it's the whole periphery of Europe, similarly got into that kind of a debt situation. Okay. Let's go back to the twin deficits idea as an analogy for explaining how this Greek debt got so large. All right. The twin deficits has to do with the U.S., has to do with neoliberalism. And how, in the 1980s, once again, this whole new approach was set up by the U.S. in relationship to the rest of the world in order for the U.S. to maintain and reassert its political economic control of the global economy at the time. The U.S. was in trouble in the 1970s. There wasn't much real investment going on. It was chronic stagflation, inflation, and unemployment, and so forth. It was a real problem. Well, why did that problem exist? Well, it existed partly because of the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, international system, back in 1973. That had a lot to do with the crisis of the 1970s. Okay, so we don't want to really look at the explain that whole 1970s crisis at this point here. We want to just look at the part of the solution, which was neoliberalism. And an important element of neoliberalism was the twin deficits. Again, twin deficits mean a trade deficit, a U.S. trade deficit with the rest of the world, and a budget deficit domestically. If you look from 1980s on, this is when the trade deficit ballooned. In other words, trade deficits occur because the U.S. starts buying more imports than it sells exports to the rest of the world. Now, at this time, China isn't involved in the whole picture, and you have the Soviet Union, so there's very little trade going on there as well. We're talking about the advanced economies, you know, Western Europe, Japan, and the U.S. The emerging market economies, Brazil, and so on and so forth, were undeveloped, largely just providing basic commodities and resources back to the advanced economies. A different version of colonialism, right, at the time. So it was a conscious policy decision by Ronald Reagan to run huge trade deficits. In other words, let's buy more from Japan and Western Europe than we're going to sell them. Now, this is a fundamental change because up until that time, the strategy of the U.S. was to compete for export sales aggressively with these other capitalist sectors of the global economy, right? But wait a minute, when your policy is no, we're going to buy more from them and sell less to them, I mean, that's 180 degrees different. Your strategy is not to maximize export sales anymore. Your strategy is to let your competitors maximize their export sales to you and run a trade deficit. Okay, so how do you do that? Well, one way you do it is raising U.S. interest rates, you see. Raising U.S. interest rates, right, raises the value of the dollar. And if the dollar rises, you American companies are less competitive with Japanese and European companies. Well, why would the U.S. do that? Why would it want to raise interest rates so much and become uncompetitive on a currency basis? Well, because if you have a higher value of the dollar, that means U.S. companies can buy more in foreign direct investment into these countries and economies around the world. You see, U.S. companies that export goods get whacked by a higher dollar. But U.S. companies that want to expand and buy up the rest of the world, well, that's a good situation for them. Their dollar buys more. They can buy more companies and more goods and get a deeper penetration, capitalist penetration, U.S. capital penetration around the world with a high interest rate, high dollar policy. U.S. exporters, you know, contrarily, would not do as good. So the whole idea was to, instead of maximizing U.S. exports, maximize U.S. foreign direct investment around the world. About that time in the early 80s, also the tax laws in the U.S. were changed. The tax laws were changed in order to give incentives for U.S. companies to go relocate abroad, called offshoring. That was part of the Reagan strategy as well. U.S. multinational companies did well under this whole arrangement. If you weren't multinational, if you were just producing in the U.S. to try to export, well, then you weren't in such a good shape, you see. So we got the Rust Belt. We got the companies moving out of the U.S., out of the Rust Belt, moving abroad and so forth. We deindustrialized the U.S. That was neoliberalism, okay, deindustrialization. But how did it occur, right? It wasn't just the tax laws that incented multinational U.S. companies to move abroad. It was the value of the dollar in the currency and the high interest rates that had a big role in the whole process that created in the process this big trade deficit, a big surplus on foreign direct investment, U.S. flowing abroad. Well, actually, for balance of payments, that was negative as well. But FDI out from the U.S. accelerates, right? Trade deficit grows within the U.S. Now, why would the U.S. want a trade deficit? Well, they want a trade deficit because they also agreed with these countries, Europe and Japan, that they would recycle that money back to the U.S., by buying U.S. treasuries. In other words, create a trade deficit where U.S. dollars flow out of the country, they accumulate in the central banks and banks of these other countries, but they're going to reroute that cash back to the U.S. to buy treasury bonds. Now, if billions and tens of billions and hundreds of billions eventually were recycling back to the U.S., guess what? U.S. government can run a budget deficit, which means that Ronald Reagan can spend more on defense and wars and give big tax cuts to his U.S. wealthy folks. The big tax cuts that began under Reagan continued ever since, under Bush and Clinton and Obama, for the rich. You know, big tax cuts make them even richer. That's why we have so much inequality growing. It's not just that wages aren't growing, it's that the rich are getting so much richer. It's two things that are driving inequality. But, they don't talk about how the rich are getting richer that much. Maybe CEO compensation, once in a while they discuss, but that's even a bigger cause of growing inequality in here. So the trade deficits allow a budget deficit, which in turn allows the U.S. government to cut taxes on the wealthy and spend more on wars and defense spending. So the trade deficit is the enabler for the U.S. budget deficit, which enables the tax cuts for the rich and the war spending. You see how it's all connected here. And it's all because the U.S. dollar is a global currency and can play this role. People elsewhere will hold on to it. Now, this whole arrangement was solidified in the mid-1980s. This was a U.S. capitalist neoliberal strategy. So how did they get the Japanese and the Europeans to buy in? Well, they had a series of meetings in 1985 where the Japanese were bought into the system in 85 as a result of what was called the Plaza Accords. Plaza Hotel in New York City is where it was all negotiated in 1985. So Japan, actually Japan was easy to convince to join this arrangement. Japan, you can sell a lot of stuff to us in the U.S. We'll run a trade deficit with you, but make sure you turn around and that you accumulate all these dollars that you recycle them back to U.S. Treasury. And that's exactly what's been happening. Our Japan's currency, dollar surplus, is well over $1 trillion and has been for some time. The Japanese were more than willing to sell more into the U.S. We'll open up our auto market to you folks and so forth. But you got to recycle the money back. Who else did we do it with? Well, there was immediately after the Plaza Accords, there was a similar agreement in Europe, the Louvre Agreement, the Louvre Museum there in Paris. Well, the U.S. cut the same deal almost with the Europeans, recycle the money back, right? You can sell more of your stuff to us. we'll buy more, we'll sell less to you. Except in key areas that, like chemicals and, high speed computers, and we want to keep that relationship, see. So it's not just you could sell us everything. There are certain things that we're off, that we're going to compete on, certain things that we're going to, really export compete with you on, but most of the stuff you can sell to us. And then, of course, there was a third global element to this similar understanding, and that was with the petrodollar countries, Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and so forth, right? We'll run a deficit with you. You'll sell us more oil. Therefore, more dollars will go out to you. But you will recycle, you Saudis and so forth, recycle the money back to U.S. Treasury. We would like you to buy a lot of F-16s in the process, et cetera, right? So, defense industry loved this arrangement, U.S. defense industry as well. And the bankers loved it because they finance all this stuff. So this was the new neoliberal twin deficit arrangement that was created. And the result was U.S. government debt escalated, tremendous amount escalated over the years. The trade deficit escalated. And of course, the budget deficit escalated. The government debt, deficits result in cumulative debt. U.S. debt went from $4 trillion, U.S. government debt, right? $1 trillion, I think it was government debt, $4 trillion total debt in the U.S. in 1980, we're $10 trillion U.S. federal government debt by 2008. 10 trillion, and we're $55 trillion in total debt, which is mostly business and banking debt, by the way. So from 4 trillion to 55 trillion from 1980 to 2007. And government debt, of course, 1 trillion to 10 trillion. Of course, now it's 18 trillion because all the bailouts and so forth, and more tax cuts for the rich, etc., just keeps going. Right, all these presidents from Reagan on are all neoliberal presidents, all of them. It's the same policies. Nothing has really changed in the U.S. except the emphasis. We got more emphasis on free trade under Clinton, but everything that Clinton did was not that different. It was just relatively different focus and different magnitudes for the different focus compared to Reagan and Bush after him. Okay. That's how the twin deficits work. And the U.S. ends up with this big debt. So how is this working similarly to explain how Greek debt got so large? Well, you need a trading currency for this to work. In the case of the U.S., obviously the dollar is the trading currency. But when Europe creates the euro and the eurozone, common currency, the euro, in 1999, then you're going to have the same process on a smaller scale begin to occur. With Germany playing the catseat role that the U.S. played globally, Germany playing this preferred role within the Eurozone, or at least you could say the core economies in the Eurozone, Netherlands, Luxembourg, so forth, Germany, in relationship to the periphery of the Eurozone and the European Union, just as the US and the UK to some extent were the core for this global twin deficit situation. Germany becomes the core to this microcosm example of a twin deficit problem within the Eurozone, and the periphery is the rest of the world. Okay? So, what happens after 2000 with the euro well in place is that the Germans and the Northern Europeans and the banks and so forth start lending all kinds of money to the periphery. Right? You've got a common currency now. So you don't have to worry about exchange rate fluctuations between, as it was before, all the different currencies of all the different European countries, right? You can just pump this money wherever you want to pump it. So they loaned all kinds of money to the periphery. Now, it was the periphery where a lot of the housing boom occurred, right? A lot of the construction boom occurred in the Euro periphery. So a lot of money from northern bankers flowed into the periphery to finance this. Well, when you got a boom going out on housing, it stimulates the rest of the economies. So these economies in the periphery, particularly Southern Europe, were going gangbusters. So more money flowed in. Northern European companies relocated to produce with the cheaper wages in these areas as well. So private money flowed in. Private bank money, as well as government loan money, and if you got the government, if you got these economies booming in Greece and Spain and Portugal, Italy, places, Ireland like that on housing and related and subsequent industries, right? Then you got to build infrastructure for all of this. So loans were being made as well in parallel to the European governments in the periphery to build the infrastructure and related expenditures. So the government rose increased, and of course, always having chronic high unemployment in these countries, they hired a lot of people into the government sector as well. So the government sector rose as the private sector boomed and rose as well in these periphery countries. And everything looked good because until 2007-8, because the economies were booming and more money flowed in wherever it was booming, more and more flowed in, both at a government level and a private level. Okay, and then hits 2008 and the crisis everywhere. Okay, so the Northern Europeans say, uh-oh, crisis, you know, all the banks and everybody pulls in their lending horns. So the periphery countries here are stuck with all this debt that has to be paid, that was built up over the previous 7 years, flowing from the north in Germany. And by the way, Germany did very well because all this money that flowed into the periphery, particularly southern periphery, was turned around to buy exports from Germany. So the people in southern, in the periphery, right, were lent all this money, and a lot of it was used to buy exports from Germany. So Germany loaned the money, but it all came back to buy their exports, which raised their economy and their economic growth nicely. Was able to raise GDP and wages and so on and so forth. Everybody benefited in the North because this was the export core. Money was lent by the North to the periphery so the periphery could buy the goods from the North. But the debt piled up in the periphery. Okay, so 2008 comes and they can't make the payments anymore. Oh, crisis. Well, gee, if they can't make the payments, maybe their banking systems in the periphery are going to collapse. Well, the government better start in the north, European Commission, IMF, 2010, better make some loans to these governments, not only to bail out the governments, but to bail out the banks. If you're going to bail out the banks in the periphery, you've got to give money to the governments because the governments in the periphery are the ones who are going to disseminate the loan money to bail out the banks. You see, it's bailing out the banks in the periphery has to go through the governments in the periphery. So the government debt rose even more. But because there was a crisis in the periphery, the governments there, you know, they used some money to bail out the banks, but they politically had to bail out the rest as well. So not all of it got to bailing out the banks in the periphery. This is 2010, and it was really worse, or most worse, in Greece and a few other places, Portugal, Spain, so forth. So in 2010, what is the Troika comes in and refinances the debt that the Greeks can't pay anymore because the money's not flowing anymore and business is in a funk everywhere. Okay. When you got a crisis, you don't generate enough income to pay previous debt, but that previous debt does not go away. You see, the previous debt has to be paid, even though you don't have as much income to make the payments anymore. And in that case, you can either be given more money to make the payments, which adds to your debt, or you can be asked to take the money somewhere else in your economy to continue making payments on this debt. Okay, those are the choices here. So in 2010, more was added to the debt because of the crisis. Previous debt built up, Germany and Netherlands and all those northerners benefited nicely, the money flowing back to them. Okay, now you have a crisis, can't make the payments on the debt. Well, give them some more money. And that's what happened in 2010. And then, however, in Europe, there was another second recession, a double-dip recession in 2011-12, which made it even worse, you see. So now they need even more money. In other words, they couldn't grow out of the crisis to make the payments. They slipped back into a recession everywhere in Europe in 2012. So they needed even more money to be lent, more credit, more debt to make payment on the previous debt. At that time in 2012, the debt in Greece was converted mostly to government-type debt from Northern Europe. In other words, the IMF threw money in, the European Commission Stability Fund threw money in, and the ECB, European Central Bank, threw money in. In that process of throwing even more money in 2012, the money was given in such a way that Greece would then pay off the private bankers, the hedge funds, the equity firms that had invested as well, you see. So the debt was restructured in 2012 in Greece to the benefit of private investors. But the Greeks ended up with the debt, you see. So that was 2012. We have the debt run-up original, you know, in the first part of the decade. We have even more debt imposed or provided with the crash in, you know, 2008-09. And then we had, again, the second recession in Europe, and even more debt had to be provided. But this time, a lot of it was used to pay off the private investors. So today, most of that $300 billion is owned to government entities. It's not owned to private bankers. It's owned to the IMF, the ECB, and the Stability Fund, bailout funds of the European Union itself, which means that they could undoubtedly expunge some of that a lot more easily if they wanted to, they, the Troika, but they don't want to, you see. So that's how we get this origin of this huge debt run-up. The Germans and the Europeans tried to replicate the twin deficit arrangements that the U.S. had pulled off so nicely in the 1980s on a global scale. After the Europeans had created their own currency, kind of like, you know, a hegemonic reserve currency within the Eurozone. You know, the Eurozone's kind of like a microcosm of the U.S. global hegemony economically, where the dollar is the hegemonic currency. And they created and tried to do the very same thing. But it wasn't quite exactly the same thing, and that's why it failed. That's why it failed, you know. It was the whole idea of creating deficits, and those deficits would then allow the money to come back. Okay, that's how the debt originated in Europe and in Greece, and that's why it's a crisis, the origins of the crisis. And we will watch over the next week whether it ends up in a default and maybe eventually an exit of Greece, not this year. Next year, an exit. Okay, Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.